Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 14th day of August, 2021. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. I want to start today by introducing my guest, David Koenig. He's been on our show. This will be his seventh appearance here on TalkRadio1.com. He is the author of Mouse Tales, Mouse Under Glass, Reality Land, The People versus Disneyland, and his most recent book, The 55ers, The Pioneers Who Settled Disneyland. He also wrote a great book on Danny Kaye, the King of Gestures. So, David Koenig, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Thank you, Stephen. So happy to be here after a long wait.
After a long and unpleasant wait during which Disneyland and Disney World were closed for different periods of time. And, of course, we've had the horrible tragedy of COVID and all of the deaths, the misery, the financial and economic, spiritual, social dislocation that it's caused. And Disneyland is a manifestation of some of that in our lives. And today, David, who is, as you could tell from those book titles, an absolute expert on Disney parks, we're going to be talking about Disneyland. And for those of you who want specifically useful information about Disneyland and Disney World, if you're planning a trip, stick with us. We're going to talk through some of the logistics of some of the things that are facing people who want to plan a trip to Disneyland or Walt Disney World. We'll do that later. But for everyone, I want to explain for a moment and then give David a chance to explain why these parks, if you can afford them, are a very positive addition to part of parenting, where you offer stimulation and education to your children as you raise them. I'm a big believer that there are four basic elements that make parents outstanding. I've talked about them many times on many shows here on TalkRadio1.com. And one of those is parents. It is one of the four big responsibilities of parents is to offer stimulation, to offer the world, to present everything the world has to offer, to show your children everything that you can think of, from things in the world to activities to the ability to manage your own life, set great goals, to achieve things, to become healthy, happy, productive, contributing members of society who learn over time how to leave things and people better than they found them. And I think Disneyland and Disney World are potentially very good assets as devices, one of many, many assets and devices for helping children do that. So it's a backdrop for family activity. It's not just, I don't support the notion that we take the kids to Disneyland for fun, although it's fun and it's part of why we take them. The reason you really want to take it is because it provides a magnificent environment for teaching. It's a teaching opportunity, and if viewed that way, there's nothing oppressive about it. Those lines that you stand in are some of the best conversations we had with our kids growing up and that we're now having with our grandchildren. David, any thoughts on that initially?
No, I could not agree more, and it's a reason why Disney trips and Disney vacations have been a part of my family's life every single year except for last year.
Yeah,
in our lives, it was what a great opportunity these trips provided to not do something just for the adults or not do something just for little kids or for the grandparents or for the teenagers, but it's an opportunity we all look forward to sharing at every stage of our lives.
In the 1950s, Walt Disney said that there should be some sort of an amusement enterprise created where. And he had this inspiration sitting on a park bench in Griffith Park in Los Angeles on Sunday, which he said was Daddy's Day with his daughters, with Sharon and Diane Disney. And he sat on a bench eating peanuts while they rode a merry-go-round. And this is when he had these thoughts. And he said, this is something we've got to do. And he also said that Disneyland will never be finished as long as there's imagination in the world. And certainly the changes that are happening at Disneyland now and at Walt Disney World now make that clear. David, do you think Walt Disney would be mostly pleased, mostly upset? And can you think of any things in particular he'd be most pleased or upset by with how Disneyland and Walt Disney World are responding to the COVID crisis?
Well, I think he would be delighted on how much beloved his creation has become. I mean, I think that's that not only that the company continues to devote the time, energy, resources, exposure to Disneyland, which, as you say, had the most humble of beginnings, and that people just continue to embrace it more and more. I think he would love that. I think individual components, we could debate, you know, piece by piece. Oh, well, he would love this, but he would hate this. And at the end of the day, you can't have definitive answers. He certainly left a lifetime of his thoughts. He never was shy about sharing what he did like and didn't like. So you could certainly base it off of his past preferences, but I think he would continue to change and evolve and that would be certainly an interesting exercise.
Disneyland opened here in Southern California on July the 17th, 1955, and the park has been closed prior to COVID. It had been closed three times. One on November 22nd, 1963, the day that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And then the second day it was closed was right after the Northridge earthquake in 1994, closed for a day. And then the park was closed on September 11th, 2001, after the events in New York and Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. It was closed for the day. Other than that, Disneyland operated more and more and more. When it first opened in 1955, it was not a seven-day-a-week operation, and it increased as they brought in millions and tens of millions and then hundreds of millions of guests. They expanded, and Disneyland became a seven-day-a-week operation that operated day and into the evening and sometimes 24 hours a day, with those exceptions. Then in mid-March of last year, Disneyland announced that they were closing for the rest of the month. In other words, for a couple of weeks. And of course, it didn't open back up again until the middle of this year. And it was closed for a long time. It had an enormous impact on the Southern California economy. It's in the multiple billions in terms of lost jobs and displaced people. And not just the jobs for the people who worked for Disneyland, but the people who worked in ancillary services, other hotels and restaurants in the Anaheim and general Southern California area. And of course, all of this is connected to not just COVID, but the government response to COVID. The Walt Disney World Park in Florida reopened in July of 2020, having closed at about the same time. It closed a little later than Disneyland, but then opened up in July and has operated continuously since. But the California park stayed closed for the rest of 2020 and for the first about half of 2021. Why?
One was located in California and one was located in Florida. That is simply and completely the answer. Disney thought and in fact had internal plans to reopen on July 17th of last year, which would have put them closed at March, April, May, June, July. So 4 months, almost to the day. That was their original plan. They were all worked up, everything that they would do, submitted plans to the local authorities, and were not allowed to reopen. So then they had a new date leading up into Christmas that they were working toward and thought they had all their ducks in a row and were not allowed to open at that point. So it's certainly not from Disney's lack of trying that they tried to reopen and tried to illustrate how in Walt Disney World, it was a with their procedures, safety procedures, that it was an ultra safe experience, but the government wasn't buying it. So
the last, so until, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so until they actually had the permission of the state of California, they didn't have a choice.
So you said local authorities. By that, you mean the governor of California, Governor Gavin Newsom?
I'm sure it was more than just him. He's certainly the face of the reason why Disneyland was closed for one person.
No, I'm sure not one person. But what I'm saying is it wasn't the city of Anaheim or Orange County, California, that said no. It was the state of California that said no.
That's correct. By local, I meant the state of California.
And the governor of Florida and Disneyland was supposed to open, according to Disneyland officials. And the last I've heard, and I heard it, I've checked it again and again, I haven't checked it in the last couple of months, but as I understand it, Walt Disney World has not yet had an event of a COVID outbreak that was looked at and attributed to anything that happened anywhere on the 43 square miles of the Walt Disney World property. Is that consistent with your understanding?
Well, it certainly, there's been no widespread outbreak that was publicized and attributed to, you know, this started at a Walt Disney World vacation and, you know, a family brought it home to New Mexico and that spread to their whole community. There's been no reports of any of that happening. That doesn't mean no one at Disney World has exchanged COVID, because I would term that possibility at pretty close to zero. I mean, just as, you know, at the supermarket or anywhere else.
Sure. No, I think that's right. But the parks in Florida have been operating on a daily basis since then, certainly a limited basis. I believe they opened up at 15% of occupancy, no lines anywhere, vacant streets. When I say streets, I mean inside of Disneyland, Main Street, and throughout the various lands and throughout all four of the theme parks in Orlando. And they've slowly increased those crowds. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's correct. It's initially it was a gradual increase, and now I don't know if they're quite at full capacity, but there are big crowds at all the Disney theme parks once again.
At Disneyland in Southern California, they opened to guests in, I forget now, was it May or April?
And I think it was April. I don't have the exact
date. Yeah, I think it was April. But they restricted it, so you could not have more than, I forget how many members from one group, and no one other than Californians could go to Disneyland all the way until June the 15th. And they required masks all the way until June 15th. And on June 15th, masks became optional, although all Disney cast members continued to wear them. And people from outside of California could go to Disneyland and Disney's California Adventure starting on June 15th. And so I went to Disneyland, specifically to California Adventure, on June 15th with my wife, with Philly, and with two friends of ours from Pennsylvania. It was the first day they would have been admitted, and we had reservations for that day on purpose because it looked like that's when California was going to lift those restrictions. And we went, and it was a wonderful time. There were a number of differences. Now, I know you've been to both Disneyland and Disney World since they reopened. What was your experience? What did you do at Disneyland? Which parks did you go to, and what did you observe?
Well, when we went to Disney World a few months ago, we just went to Epcot. It was a trip, a business trip for other things, but I had to spend at least one day, you know, at my favorite park out there. So I did go to Epcot, and then near about the 4th of July that weekend, we spent one day at Disneyland and one day at Disney California Adventure. And it was a mixture of feelings. It was primarily elation to be back.
So give me, you're talking about Disneyland now.
all three of them, every, you know, Epcot, Disneyland, and California Adventure.
Got it.
I was just primarily happy just to step through the gates. I mean, it was just, it was just one of the major things that to me was separating my life from a sense of normalcy, was that I was regularly a visitor to a Disney park every year. We were at Disney World, and throughout the year we had trips to Disneyland, and we had not had any in over a year and a half. And it was time, and it just always was something I missed and wondered about and worried. And it was just nice to be back and to see, as best we could, people smiling. There's still a lot of people wearing masks. Technically, you were still supposed to be wearing masks if you were.
Give me that date again, when you were at Disneyland.
We were at Disneyland. It was the first week of July.
Got it.
So you were still supposed to be wearing a mask if you were unvaccinated. But the folks who were vaccinated were allowed to have no
mask. That's interesting, because when I was there on June 15th, there was no distinction, and I asked six different cast members at different places, what's the deal with masks today? And they mostly stammered and said they're optional.
Yeah.
One person said, I think everybody's supposed to still be wearing them, but that was one person. The other five said, no, optional. And I did see some people in masks. There was no distinction on anything I saw that said vaccinated or unvaccinated. So that's newer, since I was there on June 15th and your visit in July.
Yeah, well, they didn't check anyone. They didn't ask. There's a couple of signs out, but there was no indication or expectation. So it is for the longest time, it's been as if it's optional, even though that was not the technical rule of that. Since then, they have recently changed over the last couple of weeks, to where you have to once again wear a mask on indoor attractions, as do cast members, but you're free to not wear a mask outside.
Were cast members outside still wearing masks when you were there in July?
Some were and some weren't.
Interesting.
And I think it related to their vaccination status.
Right.
But Disney wasn't checking for vaccination cards. And again, since then, that has changed, because they have now made it mandatory for all salaried and non-union hourly Disneyland cast members to be vaccinated before September 28th.
But they can't do that with the union members, right?
That's correct. So they've been negotiating over the last who knows how long to try and reach some sort of compromise or agreement, and a union has been adamant against that. And I don't know if it's philosophical, if it's they don't want Disneyland telling their members what to do, or if it's just a negotiating ploy that, okay, well, we'll go along with this, but in exchange, we want XYZ, so, which is what the union's normal ploy is. So we'll see what happens.
There are a bunch of unions that are represented at Disneyland. I know Culinary, and is it Teamsters? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't have the exact number, but there are, I think, 30-some unions or more, and they represent the ride operators and, merchandise and security. I mean, just vast numbers of public face.
Yeah, retail clerks and also operators of all sorts.
Right.
So, and Disney World in Florida is not as unionized, is it?
That's correct. A right to work state, so it's sort of optional.
So then, when I was there in June, a number of the restaurants were not open. A number of the rides were not open. The big rides were all open, and there were plenty of places to eat. The crowd was really relatively light. And things were, I would say, somewhat normal. Everyone who I encountered, all the guests, all the cast members seemed to be happy. And there was no overt cloud over the experience on June 15th. What did you see in July?
By then it had gotten a little more crowded, and it also, they had not by that point and since over the past month or so, a couple more facilities have reopened, but there were a number of attractions that were still closed. Fair number of restaurants that were still closed. So they had intentionally reduced their capacity, and that could have been either because they're thinking, all right, well, we're restricting attendance to say 60%. So in theory, we should only have to offer 60% of our facilities. Or a related thing is evidently they've had trouble bringing staffing back up to normal levels. So they've been restricted a bit in what they can reopen because they haven't had enough qualified employees to reopen everything. So it's probably a little bit of both.
I think it is. There is clearly a serious problem in getting employees. You know, it was interesting. I've always had such admiration for Disney Park operations and how they move people. I know that when Peter Ueberroth was going to be the head of the Los Angeles Olympic Organizing Committee in 1984, he studied for weeks at Disneyland with Disney leaders to learn Disney skills and systems for crowd management and for doing things in a way that was not authoritarian but would be highly effective. In other words, the type of leadership you want from any leader, to lead without being authoritarian. And Disney is so good at it, and it's always been something I've admired. Coming out of COVID, I have a renewed perspective on just how amazing it is. A story as simple as turkey legs. And I read an article about this, I think it may have been in the Orange County Register, that just the logistics for figuring out how to get Disney's famous turkey legs purchased and cooked and delivered and cooked and packaged, and then the people who vend it at the turkey leg counters and so forth, that just the logistics of that were going to take months to be able to put turkey legs together, not to mention everything else from churros to all the other food services, because of course they're feeding tremendous numbers of people every day, to run the parking lots, to run all of the operations. I understand, and maybe you can tell me if this is true or not, that the reason that the Disneyland parking lot trams are not running, so let me set the stage for that. The largest parking structure in the world was the Mickey and Friends parking structure, and that was true until they built a second parking structure next to it, the Pixar Pals parking structure, and so they are now the two largest parking structures in the world, and combined, I don't know who's going to be able to pass them for a while, but there's a set of clean-burning, compressed natural gas propelled trams that very efficiently carried streams of people to and from those parking structures all the way up to very close to the entrance plaza to both of the theme parks. And those trams were not running when I was there on June 15th. I believe they're still not running today. And I was told by three different cast members the reason is because they couldn't get the mechanics. They couldn't find the mechanics to keep them running reliably, and so they didn't want to run them, of course, unreliably. Can you confirm or deny that story?
I can 100% deny that story.
Sorry
to tell you, Stephen.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'll learn something. This is good.
I will confirm something. I will confirm that that's the story that Disney's telling everyone.
Ah, okay.
Actually, when COVID came, they laid off most of those mechanics. So they intentionally did not have them, left the trams with minimal of maintenance throughout the past year and a half. So they have not been kept up to the best of Disney standards. So they're not in great condition now. So part of the reason they can't restart the trams on a dime is because a lot of work will have to go into sprucing them back up, since they weren't running regularly and were quite neglected.
Yeah, they sit outside. They aren't garage. They sit outside, yeah. So I guess they get cleaned every single day or several times a day under normal conditions. And if they're left to sit in the sun and the rain for a year and a half, they're going to deteriorate.
Yeah, and as well, it's the same with your car. You should be driving it regularly, and anybody who knows, you let your car sit, an older car sit for a few weeks and then try and start it up, it's not quite as good. But the primary reason the parking lot trams are not running is because they found out by building a bridge, a walk bridge, from the parking structure, the end of the Pixar Palace parking structure, to the downtown Disneyland Hotel area, so that people now have a physical way to walk from the structure to Disneyland. That way, anybody who takes that route has saved Disney millions of dollars.
Right.
They have discovered a revenue source in not spending any money on running those parking lot trams. And I've had people who work at Disney confidentially tell me they would not be surprised if it's a couple years before they restart those trams, because they're saving so much money by forcing people to walk that mile from the parking lot structure to the parks.
You know, it's fascinating. You bring this up, and I think we don't have, of course, an awareness of how businesses operate internally. You brought something to mind that I saw this morning, and that is that Southwest Airlines reports that they spend $1.2 million on jet fuel that they can calculate because people carry cell phones as passengers on airplanes. So when you add up the weight of the cell phones, that accounts for $1.2 million a year in jet fuel. And then laptops carried by passengers on airplanes, $21 million a year in jet fuel. This was from the History Channel, the machines that built America, just for in the episode about the invention of the airplane. Just connecting to what you said, David, about the trams, and it makes sense. I have walked on that walkway that goes from Pixar Pal's south end to the entrance, to the west entrance of downtown Disney, before COVID and just after it opened, several times, and it's really very nice. It is a much longer walk to walk down the tram path, which is what now people are doing as they depart the parking structures. They have to walk along the path that the trams themselves used to take all the way to the front gate, which is a considerably greater distance. And so that seems like it's going to be a pretty big inconvenience, although a cost-saving thing. I don't know. Does that sound smart to you? It doesn't sound smart to me.
No, that's they shouldn't be doing, and especially you can think it's in the morning when you get there, if it's you and your healthy-bodied, excited kids who get there in the morning, and you're all excited, and you know you're with a 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, and you get a nice parking spot at the Pixar Pals parking structure, and you hurry down the path, you know, anticipation and excitement building with every step as you get closer and closer to the, you know, that's one thing, but it's another thing to be, you know, with grandma and grandpa and, you know, or little kids who are at the end of, you know, it's 10 p.m. at the end of a long day, and you've got to trudge back to that car, which maybe is parked in the far end of the Mickey's and Friends parking structure. And, you know, that's a completely different way to end the day rather than the old way where you could just sit on the parking lot, open an air tram and enjoy and reflect as you return to your car after a great day.
Yeah, it was definitely a longer trudge on the way. It felt like a longer walk on the way back than it did on the way there. So that's right. And just to give a sense of the size of these structures, there's, I believe, 6 stories tall, and there are escalators and elevators. But once you started, for example, at the east end where you would enter the Mickey and Friends parking structure to the west end, if you were to walk all the way to the – you enter on the southeast end, and if you had to walk to the northwest end – it's about another 10-minute walk, and I'm going to say that the walk down the tram path, either way, is probably, I'm going to say, 15 or 20 minutes. And so if you are adding an extra round trip, almost an hour of walking, on top of all the walking you do inside of Disneyland, the Disney's California Adventure, that's a lot of walking.
Yeah, and most of it's unnecessary. I mean, if they just all they have to do is bring back the trams. The trams were a day one invention of Walt Disney, and for good reason. He didn't want people to worry about it. And as well, you're already paying, I don't know what it is, $25, $26, whatever it is, to park in the structure. So, you know, there's no good reason, there's no guest-friendly reason not to have those trams running today.
Well, that brings us to the point of cost. And when the Mickey and Friends parking structure opened in the year 2000, because Disney's California Adventure had been built in what used to be the Disneyland parking lot, and the tram system opened and the parking structure, the original parking structure opened, the parking, I believe, was $8. And the parking is now $25. And right before COVID, the parking was $15, I think. Was it 15 or 20? Do you remember? I think it was 15.
It jumped up to 20 shortly before COVID. I don't know if it went from 15 to 20 or from 17 to 20, but I mean, it just overnight at the last moment did jump up to 20 because it was, we went in January of 2020, and I remember parking on that day going, $20. When did this happen?
Okay. Well, now it's 25.
So it was for a short time.
And now it's 25. And what has occurred to me, seeing a few signs, is that there may be a new plan afoot to increase costs, to increase guest costs at Disneyland and the other parks. And I see a couple of those things. First of all, the parking fee went from 20 right before COVID to 25 now. And then it appears to me that the food costs are greater. They eliminated the annual passports, but now they've brought back Magic Key, and I want to talk with you about that, which is looks like an annual passport, but it's different. And my sense is that they've made a decision that not instantly – but soon, they're going to increase the cost of everything from parking to food to merchandise to admission to annual passes, everything. And that Disneyland's going to become a more expensive place, in part, of course, to increase revenue, but in part to reduce crowd size. Now, give me your thoughts on that theory.
Well, that's ongoing. That's been... And certainly the prices will jump again. I know when they introduced about a week ago the new annual pass program, they're calling the Magic Key program, but it at its heart, it's just another slightly tweaked version of the annual pass program. People expected at that point for the prices to jump, and they were going, well, how much my pass that used to cost $1,000, is it going to be $10,000? What? Because they knew, as you say, Disney needs a way to increase revenue while reducing congestion, and you know, spiking those prices is certainly one way to accomplish both. But when the prices of the new program came out, people were pleasantly surprised that not only did the price of the passes not go up, but in a sense, it seemed like they went down at first blush. The levels of the new Magic Key program are similar with the number and frequency of blockout dates and discounts and the different levels and the Southern California only pass, but instead of being priced as they were when Disneyland closed, Disney rolled back their prices to the price that they were a couple months earlier before the last price hike. So they're actually slightly less expensive. The main difference being the main difference of the program, which is the fact that you now have to make reservations. So if you have a no blackout day pass, that does not guarantee you no blackout days. It just guarantees you a better chance to make a reservation for every day.
That's right. So let's take that one piece at a time. So you are correct. The magic key, the new annual passport, is actually stepped back a little less expensively than the old annual passport. I think it's a maneuver. I think that I think they knew that when Disneyland opened and they brought back some sort of an annual pass, that all eyes would be on the price and that speculation was it would be higher. And so I thought they would not make headlines by Disneyland increases prices and it's terrible. But if they got any coverage, it would be that the passes are more reasonably priced. They're lower priced. I think that's temporary, and I think at some point in the near future, the new passes are going to cost more. And I think that part of the psychology of it is, well, you should have bought it while it was cheaper because now it's more. And I think that on renewals down the road in a year, as things are more normal, that they will hike those, because that's been the source of a lot of visitors who come and they eat before they come. They only come for a while. They don't buy souvenirs. If they park a car, they do. And if they're not covered by an annual pass for parking, but if they don't, they park somewhat away and take a bus in, or even walk in. And so those people who frequently came daily, some people daily, and certainly many, many times a month, let alone a year, those people created crowds without creating additional revenue. And I think that's still going to be a focus of where they go to reduce congestion and increase revenue.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And that's the main group they're targeting to want to reduce. And it's the main people group, visitor group that suffers with the reservation system, the people who get the lower levels of passes are more likely to run into capacity issues.
So the reservation system is something that started as Disneyland and Disney World opened out of COVID, and it's something that I know the Disney operation wanted to put in many, many years ago, but really couldn't. A lot of people, especially in Central Florida and in Southern California, spontaneously go to Disneyland. They decide on Thursday that they're going to go on Saturday, or they decide on Sunday they're going to go on Tuesday, or for that matter, they wake up Tuesday and say, let's go to Disneyland. And it happens a lot. The reservation system means you can't really do that most of the time. You have to go online and make reservations. This is not hard to do, but you need to buy your ticket. So you've paid for your ticket if you don't have a pass, but you have to buy your pass if you don't have that. And once you buy your ticket, then you can make a reservation for that ticket. And you can change the reservation, and it's not a problem. But what it does is it prevents spontaneity, and it forces people to buy a ticket and say, yeah, we're coming. Okay, so I have people, friends of mine from high school, who are coming at the end of this month. We're going to go to Disneyland, and we bought the tickets 2 months ago and made the reservations 2 months ago. And so we have all of that in place, but paid for the tickets. Now, a lot of times someone might say, okay, we're coming in from, as my friends are, Seattle, and we'll go to Disneyland. And you get here and you say, all right, well, let's not go. Well, you're more likely to go. And if you didn't go, you bought the tickets anyway. And so this is better for Disney funding, because the money is there and the people are committed and they're more likely to show up. But it also prevents people from saying, well, you know, when we're here, maybe we'll go to Disneyland, because the answer I gave when I was told by my friends from Seattle, maybe we'll go to Disneyland, was, no, if we're going to go to Disneyland, we need to decide now so we can buy tickets now, so we can make reservations now, and so we are definitely going to Disneyland. And I think that's a device that's going to smooth out crowds, as they say, but it's going to also, it's going to allow Disney to control crowds much, much more, so that they can say, yeah, well, you know what? We're full on this day, on Tuesday. Why don't you come Wednesday? Because you'll see on the website, you can't get in on Tuesday, so you better come Wednesday. And the in this way, they'll smooth things out, not just through the week, but through the month and through the year, so that crowds will be more even, and they don't need to flex up and down by hiring more part-time people who might be less stable or more expensive or less well-trained. They can anticipate their needs much better in advance. I think reservations are here to stay.
Yeah, I think you're right. They actually did start before COVID. In 2019, Disneyland introduced an experimental level of annual pass called the Flex Pass. And this was one that had, in theory, minimal blackout days, but it required you to make a reservation. And it was sort of the precursor to the new system and worked fairly well for the people who had it, because they had a allowance of people with flex passes who would be allowed to go each day and make reservations. And those who purchased the flex pass were people who were flexible and not an overwhelming large group of people. So they were able, from what I understand, everyone I spoke with who did purchase a flex pass was very happy with it, because since they were not competing with a million other flex pass owners, they were able to get in on short notice and make reservations. And it supposedly was a very smooth system. The trick Disney will run into now is that, in an essence, all the passes, all levels are flex passes. So I don't think it will go quite as smoothly, where folks will be able to, at the last minute, continue to make last minute reservations and continue to go to Disneyland every single day they want to. Some of those days are inevitably going to be filled up, because Disney will make allowances day by day. Okay, we're going to allow X number of this level pass in today, X number of this, X number of this, and X number of this. So those will be filling up. And as well with the Magic Key program, each level has a varying number of reservations that you can make. If you have the highest, a big dollar, I don't know, it's like about $1,400 pass, you can make, I think, 6 reservations.
That's right.
So that in theory, you could block out a few days for Christmas time when you know that you're going to have to make those way in advance, and then use the others to sort of float, make them a couple for this week, couple for next week, however you want to do it, and in theory be able to go most days, although some of those days may fill up. But the lower level you get down the pass, the more you're going to run into trouble, I fear.
Yeah, the least expensive Southern California only Magic Key, you can only hold 2 reservations at once. And that's $400 a year, as opposed to $1,400 a year for 6 reservations at a time. And then free parking on the top pass, but 50% off parking on the second pass, and no free parking and more blockout days for the lower passes. It's going to be an interesting thing to see how it goes. Also, if you went to Disneyland spontaneously in the old days, you might find out that by noon or 2 in the afternoon, you couldn't get in because they said, we're closing the park. It's too many people. So they would turn you away at the gate. They would say, you're not coming in. And that won't happen now. But on the other hand, when you go to make reservations, you might find yourself turned away at your computer days or weeks or months in advance if you're picking a particularly popular day. So there'll still be shutouts, but again, they'll be spread around, and you won't discover it when you arrive at the park. You'll know it well in advance.
Right, exactly so. And I think depending how well Disney is able to approximate how much demand from each annual pass level and how many people actually participate and how frequently they want to travel, that will lead to how smoothly things go and how happy the customers are. I can only imagine if you buy a pass for however many hundreds of dollars and every day you want to go is filled up already and you have to, yes, I'm allowed technically to go to 160 days a year, but I'm only able to, at the end of the year, I was only able to go six times. You might not have completely happy customers.
Steakhouse 55 was a wonderful steakhouse previously known as Granville Steakhouse at the Disneyland Hotel. And Steakhouse 55, I understand, is now permanently closed and is going to be replaced either by a new restaurant or an expansion of Goofy's Kitchen. Do you know?
I don't know which it will be. I would not be surprised if Goofy's Kitchen does expand, because that Disney seems to make the most money the more it Mickeyizes something. the more mouse ears they could put on something, typically the more popular it is. So Goofy's Kitchen is extremely popular, at least pre-COVID.
Well, it's a buffet, and it was magnificent, and the food is actually really good for a buffet, which generally isn't, you know, the top cuisine, but this really was very good. So it won't surprise me if it expands, but it seems to me that the fine dining steakhouse, when I was at Steakhouse 55, it's always been full, and you couldn't get in if you didn't have reservations.
Yes, yeah, I think they were able, though, with as full as Steakhouse 55 may have seen on a day here or there, Goofy's Kitchen was always full. My guess is that seems to make more sense, because just like Granville's before it, Steakhouse 55 could be full based on if everything else was full, but it was rarely the restaurant that filled up first.
Interesting.
And as well, with the buffet, like at Goofy's Kitchen, you're guaranteed that each guest will spend a minimum amount.
That's true. That's true.
With Steakhouse 55, you'll certainly have some guests who will come in and they'll get the most expensive. You'll get the shrimp cocktail, and then you'll and all, you know, five course meal with different wine. You'll get that absolutely, but you'll also get people who come in and just get a whatever the least expensive thing is on the menu and a glass of water and call it a day. And there's no doing that at Goofy's Kitchen. Whatever, I don't know what the price is now, but I'm sure it's high, and everyone's got to pay the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's like $50, $60, $70 a person at Goofy's Kitchen. Something like that,
right?
Yeah. So at Walt Disney World, where we are scheduled to go in October, we're going to, a whole group of us, the family, are going to go in October to Disney World. The situation there, I understand, is still in a rapid state of flux. Dining reservations, which typically you could make at Walt Disney World 180 days before your first day of arrival, you can now only make 60 days before your first day of arrival. I understand there was a glitch on the computer this week that I learned from DFB, the Disney food blog, that there was a glitch that allowed people to scroll forward by 180 days, but when they tried to make a reservation, it showed an error message. So it suggests that somebody's doing some computer experiments at Disney to maybe restore the 180 days. Do you know anything about this?
I don't know exactly what their plans are, and my guess is Disney doesn't even know exactly what their plans are. The main reason why they've had to restrict the reservation time to 60 days in advance instead of the traditional 180 is because they don't know what their dining inventory will be until they get closer, because they don't know which facilities are going to reopen. They don't know what the capacity limits will be. So what's happened over the last, however long, a year or so that Disney World's been open, is they've restricted the dining advance reservations to 60 days, and then as requirements or capacities changed, they filtered extra reservations into the system so that there are some people who are just all through the day, every day, checking on well, can I make my reservation for you know, Les Celliers for my particular date now? No, and I'll check back. No, no, no. And they'll keep checking back in hopes that one will be added to the system, and often are. And in fact, there's been several services, I understand, of people who, if you pay them money, they will watch the, you know, regularly watch for you and alert you when it's your desired time and place is open.
So there's some question as to whether there will be, because of the Delta variant, a retrenchment. And as you pointed out, David, there already has been to some extent because masks must now again be worn indoors at Disneyland and I believe Disney World as well. Is that right?
Yes.
And so there was a call. It was the third quarter financials for the 2021 fiscal year. They hold an earnings call with shareholders. And during the call, various Disney representatives and officials commented on capacity and attendance levels of the park. They announced a number of things and talked about planning. Disney CEO Bob Chapek also made some comments about the future of Disney with the COVID-19 Delta variant and the potential impact it could have on the company. And so from those comments in this third quarter call, one individual asked whether Disney is seeing any impact from the Delta variant in terms of how things look moving forward. And Bob Chapek, again, the CEO of the Walt Disney Company, now said, in quote, "In terms of the Delta variant, we're seeing strong demand for our parks continuing," end quote. He noted that the park reservation system they're using is now actually seeing attendance above the third quarter attendance levels. He continued by saying that the park pass reservation system will enable the Disney parks to, quote, "spread our demand, increase the yield, and improve the guest experience at the same time," end quote. He said that he believes that some of the costs associated with things needed for hygienic purposes will be relatively short-lived. Again, cost-cutting, as those things can be removed. He added that the bigger, longer-lasting impact will be with the improvements Disney is making when it comes to guest personalization and guest choice. He said this will only grow in the future with their ability to do world-class yield management through the new reservation management system. And this, of course, is why I think the reservation system is here to stay forever at all Disney parks and will probably spread to Six Flags and Cedar Fair parks and other amusement parks around the country. Thoughts?
Yes, I think at Disney, at least, it will remain. With other parks, I'm not so sure because they don't have the gift of constant maximum demand that the Disney parks do. So, I mean, there was up until recently, all the major theme parks throughout Florida, Universal, SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, they all required reservations. And over the last few months, they've been most of those parks have been dropping the reservation requirement because they realized it's one extra hoop that's a potential barrier to people attending. And they, since they don't have the constant threat of maximum sellouts, they want to remove that to encourage, but to not scare off people who go, oh, I have to make a reservation, or maybe they're full, or oh, this is too much trouble. So I don't know if somebody's a Six Flags park that's somewhat struggling to get attendance, I'm not sure that that's the type of park that will then institute mandatory reservations for all attendees, even though they would love to have that because it certainly provides, as you say, for planning and staffing and purposes.
Back to the pricing. In 1984, I was in Chicago on business, and I ate at a place I'd never eaten before. I was there as a practicing lawyer. I was there for a lawsuit, and I went out with co-counsel, the lawyers that we were working with in Chicago, and we went to a place called Morton's of Chicago, and it was a steakhouse. And I'd never been to any place like this. This is 1984. So you have no such thing as Morton's here or Mastro's or Fleming's or Wolfgang's in New York or Peter Luger in New York. You don't have steakhouses like this across the country. You have a couple of them, but this is 1984, so I guess some 37 years ago now. And I was blown away by a few things. First, the quality of the steak was fabulous, and the service was terrific, and the environment was truly wonderful, a luxurious environment in the restaurant. And everything was a la carte. So the steak came on a plate, and it didn't come with anything. You ordered sides. This was unheard of at the time. You ordered sides, you ordered appetizers, everything was separate. There was no such thing as a meal. Does that come with mashed potatoes? No, didn't come with anything. You have a separate menu for everything. And of course, the cost was much higher. And today, those restaurants are thriving. Again, here in Southern California, Mastro's and Fleming's, and Morton's is all over Southern California as well. And a number of different places do this very same thing. It's all expensive. It's all a la carte, and it's not always full. They fill up, you know, Saturday night, you better get your reservation by Tuesday, but you can go pretty much most nights without a reservation, and sometimes even on a Saturday night, it's not full, but they follow it because they can make so much money from fewer people. And so, applying this to Disneyland, do you see a time, David Koenig, where sometime in the next few years, the philosophy of Disneyland, not just to increase yield, not just to reduce crowds some and increase prices continuously, but do you see a time when the price of an admission ticket or an annual pass or parking or food or anything else will be significantly higher with the idea that they want to significantly improve the guest experience of the people who are there, so it's that much better. The lines are shorter, the crowds are less, there's not the shoulder-to-shoulder thing it sometimes becomes, but the cost is so dramatically larger that people who today could say, yeah, I'll buy an annual pass, or yeah, I'll go to Disneyland two or three times a year, might say, you know what, I might not go for two or three years because I really need to not spend that much money. It's just too expensive. And others would say, sure, I'll pay more because it's a better experience.
Yes and no. I think your theory about the end goal is 100% dead on. I don't know that that in the next couple of years they'll ever raise the admission price to – say $500 to get in. Eventually it may get there, but certainly not in within the next few years, because they just have too many bodies they need to get into the park to make it flow and operate properly. It's a problem they had this summer, was they did not think they would be introducing the new annual pass program so quickly as they did. But once they'd run through everyone willing to pay $100 to $150 a shot, the crowds, as the summer went on at Disneyland, did start coming down because they just had exhausted that supply. And the folks who did want to be there every week or every day could not afford to pay, you know, $150 for a Saturday trip in July. So Disney's going to eventually, I'm convinced, achieve what you're talking about, but in a slightly different way. And that will be not taking your money in, you know, extremely higher amounts all at once. What they're going to do is I'm fairly convinced, is whether it's by the end of this year or sometime next year, is they're going to reintroduce FastPass, but they're going to charge money for it per attraction. It's what they introduced earlier this year at Disneyland Paris and then at Shanghai Disneyland. And so if you want that premium, less crowded, lower weight experience that that you're talking about, it won't be in getting $500 from you in the front end. It'll be getting $500 from you on the back end, because you'll still spend your $150 to get in, but then you're going to spend $9 to get a fast pass for Peter Pan, and then you're going to spend $7 to get a fast pass for Dumbo, and then you're going to spend $16 to get a fast pass at Rise of the Resistance. And if it's a party of four, by the end of the day, I need my calculator to figure out how much of your money they've taken.
Which is kind of an interesting return to something similar, something reminiscent of but different from A through E tickets, where you didn't used to be one price you pay and you go in and everything else is included. It used to be that you'd get a book of tickets, a book of 10 or a book of 15 tickets, and they had A tickets for the less spectacular rides, and an E ticket ride was the ultimate experience. And then they shifted it, I think in part in response to Magic Mountain, a Six Flags park here in Los Angeles, where they created a one price, no extra, everything's included idea, and Disneyland followed in that. Now, Knott's Berry Farm and Six Flags both sell the equivalent of a fast pass for additional money. And I think you're right. I think we're going to see a fee for fast pass comes back.
I just got a list of some of the sample prices of fast passes at Disneyland Paris. And if you want a fast pass on Autopia, it'll cost you $9. Buzz Lightyear Laser Blast, $18 if you want to get per line for that. Star Wars, $11. Star Tours, $9. Peter Pan, $18 to get a fast pass for Peter Pan. $14
per person, right?
Big Thunder. Per person. So you can imagine if you want a shorter line, a shorter wait to go on Peter Pan, it's going to cost you an extra $75 for your party of four.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is really very much like the Morton's of Chicago Steakhouse idea, where the steak itself is going to cost you this much. So that would be the admission price. But then there's going to be the parking and the fast pass, and the food will cost more and so forth. So that by the time you get out, you thought the steak was really expensive when you ordered the steak, but by the time you add an appetizer and a vegetable and maybe mashed potatoes and a dessert and then have a drink, you've spent more on the other items than you did on the admission ticket to begin with.
Right. The difference is Morton's not charging a $150 cover charge just to walk in the door.
So the business we'd rather be in would be the Disneyland business rather than the steakhouse business.
I think they both have a good thing going. as long as you have a good product and there's a demand for it, then it becomes up to them to market it and operate it properly and to keep that demand flowing and maximize that profit. In a sense, I don't begrudge Disneyland Paris for charging these outrageous upcharges, $18 per person for a ride. In a sense, I'm more relieved than it's not like $5 a ride, because if it were something that weren't that much more, you would get a huge percentage of your guests that would want to go into the fast pass line.
Sure.
But now the majority of your guests can't afford, maybe they'll do this on one ride for an extra $10, but you're not going to get a huge number of guests that are going to pay $18 extra for
10 rides.
Each person at party for 10 rides. That's a very small group of people that will not have that great an effect on the standby wait. And I will say my trips to Disneyland, California Adventure, and Epcot over this summer, the thing that I noted that I was most happy with, we'll say, is even though the lines for most of the rides that we went on were not short, they were fairly long lines, but they moved the whole time because they were old-fashioned Disneyland lines. They did not have the fast pass running so that the standby line was the only choice. And so all the lines were constantly moving as opposed to constantly stopping in the age of FastPass.
That's right, because the way it works with FastPass is they stop the standby line so the people in the FastPass line go through. And if you let in, you know, 100 people from the FastPass line while the standby line is standing by, they didn't move for a while. So you're absolutely right. I remember noticing that when I was there in June, that as you say, the line was much longer, but it moved much faster, and net was like the old days, which I thought was good.
Yeah. You never want a line where the title of it is stand. That's all you did. I want a move line, not a stand line.
That's right. That's right. David Koenig, I want to say thank you. This is always fun. Today was no exception. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I would love to do it again when we have some additional experience downstream in a few months with the crowds, the prices, the systems, and so forth. Thank you so much for being with me again today here on TalkRadio1.com.
Thank you, Stephen. I loved it.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been David Koenig, and I would encourage you to buy his book. You can buy it right here, right now on the TalkRadio1.com website, The 55ers, The Pioneers Who Settled Disneyland. This is a fascinating thing, the book, with a number of pictures throughout, and stories that don't just give you the history of Disneyland, but this is really the history of America in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. This is the history of America and Southern California and life here as was reflected in the operation of Disneyland, the idea and the people who started it, so many different stories of the origins of it. And I would also encourage you to buy David's other books. I'm going to give you my email address in a moment. If you'd like a list, just email me and I'll be glad to send you not just a list of his books, but also links to the other 6 shows where David Koenig has been a guest on this show. So my thanks to David for joining me today here on TalkRadio1.com. My thanks to Walt Disney for coming up with the whole idea to begin with. My guest next week, 1 week from today, is going to be James Wallman. He has written a book called Time and How to Spend It, The 7 Rules for Richer, Happier Days. And this is the same man who we had on back in 2016 to talk about his book called Stuffication, Why We've Had Enough of Stuff and Need Experience More Than Ever, which really heralded, before it became the trend, the notion that younger people in particular were much more willing to pay for experiences than they were for things, and that's changing the economy under us, and it has impact on everybody's life, no matter whether you are a salaried worker or a person in your own business, whether you're beginning and you're in your 20s or you're trying to retire. This is going to make a difference. That book, Stuffication, will be primarily discussing time and how to spend it. That is next week, 1 week from today, Saturday, August 21, 2021, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Use our PayPal link, our Amazon link, and our eBay link if you want to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com without costing you anything extra. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.